I want the freedom.
Just living in the moment.
Give me a good uppercut.
Picked out therapy.
Telling the most shocking lies.
Oh, is this Triple J? Brilliant.
Not in Chad Thomas.
Hello, Tom Tilly with you for Hack. Are you pretty responsible when it comes to drink driving? Do you get a taxi home when you've had a few too many drinks? Pick up the car the next day? Well, new research says that driving hungover can be just as dangerous as driving under the influence of alcohol. Stick around to find out how big a risk you're taking when you drive hungover. And have you ever seen a ghost? Yeah, turn off the lights, pull out the torch. We're talking ghost stories on Hack. Find out why in just a moment.
You're listening to Hack with Tom Tilly, Triple J.
It looks like Australia and Indonesia might be on the brink of makeup sex. The relationship got pretty ugly when it was revealed senior Indonesians, including the president and his wife, had their phones tapped by Australia in 2009. Now the Indonesian president says he's up for giving the relationship another shot. But as Julia Holman reports, there'll be some new house rules.
Tony Abbott and Indonesian President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono have been writing letters to one another to try to piece together their relationship. And overnight, Mr. Abbott received the latest correspondence.
It was a very warm statement. It was a statement that was very positive about Australia.
Using very careful language, the Prime Minister said he's considering Indonesia's request for an accord between the two countries, including a set of protocols Australia must adhere to.
I'm going to reflect on the statement over the next day or so, and then we'll be responding more fully.
And just like any good relationship, Mr. Abbott says the two countries should be more open with each other.
What I'd like to see in the future is some kind of a security round table where we are more open with each other, where we build even stronger relationships of trust.
As well as cutting off diplomatic ties, Indonesia was also threatening to restrict trade, including live cattle exports. And at this delicate point, Australia doesn't want any more upsets. But that's exactly what Trade Minister Andrew Robb appeared to do this morning.
It is unfortunate that this taping that took place several years ago has been made public.
The cabinet minister appeared to inadvertently admit to something that's never meant to be disclosed, that Australia did, in fact, spy on Indonesia.
It's a fact of life. We've got to deal with it, and the Prime Minister is seeking to deal with it effectively.
Andrew Robb later released a statement where he said he hadn't admitted to anything, and anyway, he's not privy to that kind of information. The Immigration Minister, Scott Morrison, says there's many reasons Australia's got to mend ties.
It is not just about people smuggling, is it about trade? It's about the connections between two very robust and friendly peoples. And that is where we want to see the relationship head in the future, and that's what everyone's working very hard to achieve right now in what has been a challenging time.
And opposition leader Bill Shorten says he believes repairs are underway, but there's a lot of work to be done.
It's not a time just to simply say, you know, there's no problem here, nothing to look at. It's a time to roll up your sleeves. It's a time to recognise and put yourself in the other person's position and come to a sensible landing point.
But what exactly is Australia going to have to give in order for the relationship to be repaired?
I'm sure anything in terms of a commitment in this sort of intelligence sphere is more than what Australia would like to give.
Dr. Christopher Roberts is from the National Security College at the Australian National University. He says although Australia will have to concede some ground, the Indonesians may have forgiven the phone taps.
The emphasis was that the Abbott government would not do anything in the future to undermine. And to some extent, this perhaps puts a line on what might have happened in the past. And hopefully that's a line that the Abbott government can fall on.
He says the Indonesian president is likely to be demanding that Australia agree to limit the level of surveillance.
In some ways, this is a plus in that by having an accord, he's acknowledging that there will be activities undertaken in the future, but perhaps trying to set certain boundaries on just how far those activities might go.
But he also says there's much more between the two countries than just a relationship between the two governments.
It's perhaps more robust than we might think, and we also have to bear in mind that as a democracy, Indonesia now must respond to the demands of the people, just as much as sometimes Australian politics can be caught up on the domestic side of things.
Triple J, Hack with Tom Tilly.
Dr. Christopher Roberts from the Australian National University speaking to Julia Holman, and Tim's texted in saying, do Tony Abbott and SBY not have email or phones? Who writes letters these days?
I want the freedom of travel.
No, I'm here to enjoy myself.
Triple J.
Do you get lots of lols out of internet memes? Well, in lots of cases, the people making them are risking being busted for breaking Australian copyright law. As Stephen Stockwell reports, there's an online community push to change our copyright laws, laws that many say are archaic and limiting our online lols.
Welcome to Juice Wrap News, our 20th edition, and we'd like to thank you on this...
Remember this Juice Wrap News from the election? They parodied John Farnham's You're the Voice in the clip, with Julian Assange singing. It ended up being taken off YouTube because a copyright owner threw their weight around.
The publishing company of one of the writers decided to, you know, take issue with it and put in a DMCA notice for copyright infringement on the episode.
Hugo Ferrant created Juice Wrap News with Giordano Nanni. Even though they were pretty sure they could fight the claim using Australia's fair dealing provision, it was going to be expensive.
We're not going to enter into a battle which we can't really afford, but we will definitely join the battle for reform in the law so that we don't have to fight these kinds of battles in the future, so that it's much more clear what the law is, and it makes much more sense in the modern digital society.
Good artists borrow, great artists steal.
Nick Souza is a senior law lecturer at Queensland University of Technology.
Reusing existing material really is what creativity is, taking things from our culture and re-expressing them to say something new. And the problem is that our current copyright laws don't recognise that enough.
Copyright law is there to protect the interests of the original creator. It punishes people who essentially try and steal someone else's work and use it for their own benefit. But Nick reckons our laws are too fierce and that they stifle creativity.
In the US, there is an exception called fair use, which allows people to make certain uses which would normally be infringements of copyright if that use is socially valuable in certain circumstances. Basically, the courts look to whether the use is valuable, whether it's good for society on the one hand, and on the other hand, they look at how much harm or damage the copyright owners would suffer.
Nick Burkey, who you might know as Pogo from YouTube, chops up films to make songs like this. It might be hard to recognise there, but that's actually all samples from Alice in Wonderland. He got caught out once when Sony tried to take one of his videos down.
I filed a YouTube counterclaim notice just saying, look, this is fair use. I haven't really... This is free viral marketing that we're talking about here. And, you know, within a couple of days, the video was put back online. So there is definitely defence out there for people who are remixing content like this.
That's if it's a US company and it falls under fair use, though. Outside of that experience, because of his YouTube celebrity status, production houses are actually now coming to Nick, asking him to mash up their work.
It's basically just an agreement that says, look, here's a feature film or here's a series, a TV series, and we want you to take all the sounds and voices and turn it into a song or turn it into a musical piece that goes on YouTube and collects a bunch of views and gets people talking about the film.
Right now, Australia's copyright laws are being reviewed. The Australian Law Reform Commission is looking at ways to update our pretty dusty legislation. Artists and comedians are hoping it suggests a fair use provision, like what they have in the US. But Nick O'Byrne, the general manager of the Australian Independent Record Labels Association, reckons this will see creators getting ripped off.
If you start enacting some sort of greater freedoms or more lax laws around copyright, what you're doing is actually taking the control over one's own property away from the owner of that property and allowing other people to use it potentially for their own financial benefit.
Nick says the current legislation already offers plenty of freedom for creativity.
If you feel like letting people use, you know, your beats or horn lines or whatever it may be in a song of their own, you have absolutely the ability to let them do that and give people as much freedom as you want. On the flip side, you also have the ability, which is really important, to think, no, that's really special to me. I want it to stay as it is. I don't want people to muck around with it.
Nick Souza from QUT does expect the ALRC to suggest fair use, but says it's hard to tell if the government is actually going to listen and update the laws.
I think there's a very compelling case for fair use. I think it's also a very politically difficult arena. There is a lot of money on the sides of publishers in particular who are violently opposed to fair use, so it becomes a very difficult political argument.
Triple J, Hack with Tom Tilley.
Nick Souza from QUT ending Stephen Stockwell's report.
Hack.
It's hard to kind of explain it outside of, you know, the scandalous nature of God's grace.
Hack. Triple J.
Yes, you are listening to Hack on Triple J with Tom Tilley. Now, when I ask you, have you seen a ghost? Do you imagine some crazy figure wandering around in a white sheet? Or do you imagine a dead relative giving you a really important message that might change your life? Stick around to find out why we're talking about ghost stories. Well, the reason is a very interesting film that you'll find out about in just a moment. Now, imagine you're nearing the end of a nice night out. You've had a few too many drinks to get behind the wheel, so you catch a taxi home. Sounds kind of intelligent, right? Well, it is, but what you might not realise is that when you get up hungover the next morning and go get your car, you could face the same risk of an accident driving hungover with no alcohol even left in your system, and just a similar risk as driving directly under the influence. That's according to new research from a UK and a Dutch university, and I'd love to hear from you. If you've had incidents driving hungover, give me a call.
Hack 1300 055 36. Text 0439 75 7555.
To explain how getting behind the wheel with no alcohol in your blood could be more dangerous than driving with alcohol in your blood, we have the study's author, Chris Alford, with us from the University of the West of England. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Chris, it sounds almost counterintuitive after all the messaging we've grown up with around the dangers of drink driving. Driving hungover has never really been mentioned. How did you make this discovery?
Well, it's really two studies, one that I've done and one that some colleagues in the Netherlands have done. And what we've both done is study the effects of alcohol on our driving simulators before. So we get participants, they'll drink some booze and then they go out and drive. And we can see in the simulator just how impaired they are as a result of that. And we have that data. What we've done this time is we've taken people and measured them twice. Once when they've driven normally without having been out drinking the night before, and then again when they've had a night of drinking. And what we find the next day, even though their blood alcohol can go back down to zero, so technically they'd be legal to drive, in fact, when you assess that driving, they're impaired over the limit.
Being hungover can encompass a range of feelings. You can feel lethargic and then jittery and sometimes even energetic in a weirdly adrenalized sort of way all at once. What is it about being hungover that makes driving so dangerous?
Well, I think it's effects on the brain, really. When we take substances such as alcohol or indeed other drugs, they can modify the way that the brain works. And if you take something and you have, you know, like with alcohol, you have your period of intoxication and you might feel quite fine then. On the other hand, when you start coming out of that and your alcohol levels drop, then you go into a deficit situation. And during that recovery period, that's when we can see this impairment. And as I say, even though the alcohol's gone, you can't measure it anymore, you could still find that the brain's recovering and you're impaired. And so you're not driving as well as you should be. And indeed, you're driving as though you're over the legal limit for alcohol.
How much does being hungover impair your driving compared to drinking alcohol? Because I imagine if you got completely wasted, say you were 0.1 or 0.2 or something full on like that, that would be much worse than driving hungover.
Yeah, I think that's a good question, Tom. I think in this study, what we were finding was in the Dutch study, they found that in the levels of impairment were equivalent to being over the legal limit. So that's 0.05 level. They weren't getting up to the 0.1 level. But if you perhaps really did have a heck of a night out, in the study we're talking about, people had about 10 standard drinks. Okay, but if you know yourself, perhaps, that people can go over that level. So if you had a really big session, then indeed you may find that your impaired driving in the hangover state was even worse. But that's not a study we've done yet, but it will be interesting to look at.
You're listening to Chris Alford from the University of the West of England, and he's published a study that shows driving hungover with no alcohol in your system can be just as dangerous as driving under the direct influence of alcohol. And if you've had problems driving hungover, I'd love to hear from you. 1-300-055-36 is the number, 1-300-055-36. Chris, we've got breathalyzers to test for blood alcohol level. Is it possible to test for being hungover?
Well, at the moment, we don't. So you could be stopped by the police, you've got a hangover, and you wouldn't have measurable breath alcohol. But there are some biochemical compounds in your blood that we can measure that seem to reflect the amount of drinking you've done the night before. So indeed, there are some things that we could look at, and it may be possible to develop a test in the future. But I think a better thing is really just for us all to be a bit more responsible. And if we're going to have a drink, we say, well, I know I shouldn't get straight in my car. After having my drink, I'll get a taxi or I'll find a way of getting home where I don't have to drive. Maybe we should just think again and extend that and say, if I've had quite a heavy session drinking and I've got a hangover, no, I'll make an alternative arrangement in advance. I'll get a friend to drive me or book a taxi or public transport or something. That's probably the best approach.
Okay, but the next morning, if you're going to pick up your car and you're still hungover, that's clearly a problem, according to your research. So how long should you wait for the effects of being hungover to wear off?
Right. Well, we haven't done that study again. That will be one for the future, just to see how long it took for people to come back to normal. So I think before we've got that data, and people vary, of course. Some people have a couple of drinks and they say that's enough for me. Some people can drink a bit more, and we probably find the same with recovery from hangover. There'll be a natural variation between people there. So until we've got that result or got that data, it's probably best just to say, look, play on the safe side and make an alternative arrangement in advance.
Chris Alford, thanks so much for joining us on Hack.
Okay, thank you. It's been great.
Hack with Tom Tilley. Triple J.
Chris Alford from the University of the West of England. And Mark's called in from Melbourne. Mark, you drove the day after a big night. What happened?
Yes, it was the day after New Year's. We were down at Mansfield and we had a night of heavy drinking during New Year's, obviously. And we went out to lunch and we got there at about 10 and then we left there at about, say, 2:30.
Did you drink at lunch?
Didn't have any drops since I went to sleep. So we knew we were driving home the next day. I think I had about 5 coffees. As I was driving out of Mansfield, there was a booze bus and it pulled me over and they breathalyzed me and asked me to step out of the vehicle. And they said, just stand over there, we'll be back in 10 minutes. So after about 10 minutes, she came up and breathalyzed me again. She just basically said, well, you're on the way down, so you haven't been drinking today. And she told me the readings. The first one was 0.049 and the second was 0.048. And because I was hungover, my illusion of being under, granted I was right, but I was a hundredth of a percent right, it was completely off. So like, you get this illusion because you've had a good night's sleep that the alcohol's gone and you feel better, but the alcohol's still there and it's not completely in sync with what they're saying about having no alcohol in your system, it still affects you.
Yeah, well, you're talking about the length of how long it takes for the alcohol to get out of your system, let alone the following process, which is dealing with the hangover when you've got no alcohol left.
Precisely, and because it's the next day, you're not familiar with how much alcohol you might have in your system as opposed to the previous afternoon where you're drinking and you're fully aware of it. And one, you could still be drunk and you don't know, and then you could have an accident, or two, you could get pulled over and severely fined or lose your license.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mark. I'd love to hear from you. If you've had an experience where you'd been out drinking and you'd done the right thing, you'd actually basically not driven at all while you had any alcohol in your system, but then you still felt woozy, you still felt under the influence of the night before whilst drinking hungover, because we've come across this very interesting study that says you can be at just as great a risk of an accident driving hungover as actually driving around 0.05% blood alcohol level. A few people texting in. One person says, hangovers are a great experience, why ruin it by driving? Another person says, if I didn't drive while hungover, I would never get to work. Give me a call, 1300 055 36, 1300 055 36, or you can text in 0439 757 555. Cameron's called in from Traralgon. Cameron, what's your experience with driving hungover?
Well, I live in country Victoria, so basically if I need to go anywhere, I'll need to drive. And I agree completely with Chris about the fact that you are just as impaired, but the thing is, whenever I've had to gone out, had a few, I always make sure I wait till later in the day, but I still need to go home. And I've got no people to take me out there. So when I do drive, I'm always aware that, okay, I'm not feeling good. So I'm always extra cautious while hungover.
Yeah, what does it feel like for you when you do drive hungover?
Well, basically, it's sort of a bit hazy in a way, like mainly because often my stomach's a bit upset or I'm just thinking, oh, I feel like crap.
Yeah, totally. Well, that corresponds with the research. Matthew, thanks so much for the call. Paddy's called in from Byron Bay. Now, Paddy, you've been pulled over. What happened? Were you hungover or did you still have alcohol in your system?
No, I was pulled over the day after, just a Friday night on the curbs, and pulled over in Bretho. I blew like 0.2 or something. I was well under the limit. But, about 5 minutes after being Bretho, I ended up crashing car due to poor reflexes.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. I guess that goes exactly to the point of the research.
Yeah, definitely.
So have you changed the way you act now around drinking, around driving the next day?
Usually just try and dodge it for a good while. If I'm feeling at all sort of typical hangover symptoms.
How long do you give it?
Usually an afternoon. I usually get up pretty early, but, yeah, I'll wait for the afternoon.
Yeah, all right. Thanks so much for the call, Paddy. A few people still texting in. One person says, my mum and dad gave me the lesson not to drive until the following evening. Good parenting.
Hack. Shall we say embarrassing language?
The more sordid elements.
Good, decent Australians.
Hack. Triple J.
Turn off the lights, shine the torch up under your chin. It's time to tell a few ghost stories. But maybe not the corny, ridiculous ghost stories you might tell around the fireplace or see from Hollywood. There's a new film out from the director that made Samson and Delilah. Warwick Thornton's new film, The Dark Side, looks at stories of ghost sightings by Indigenous Australians and sightings by non-Indigenous Australians of Indigenous Australian ghosts. It's an artistic film that has actors sitting down and retelling the real Australian ghost stories. Warwick says he was tired of Hollywood hijacking the meaning of ghost stories, and he's seen a ghost himself.
I seen a little girl when I was around about, I think it was about 26, staying at my brother's house, and this little girl just rocked up in the corner of the room and she was holding a baby. She was trying to put a little baby to sleep.
How old was the girl?
I don't know. She probably would have been about 7 or 8, maybe. She was about that height. And she just was in the corner, and it was really calming. It was really beautiful. It wasn't oh my God, this is, the scary, It wasn't spinning heads and it didn't have horns and didn't have red eyes or anything. It was just really beautiful and calm. And after around about, probably about 10 minutes, she just faded away. And then I just went back to sleep.
I'd seen this little girl and then I'd found this little boy. And they just said, no, that was his little spirit. She's looking after him.
Why did you make this film? What do ghost stories mean to you?
I kind of grew up with, sort of the spirituality around me as being an Indigenous person. We've been taught from day one of birth that, our ancestors surround us, whether they're trees or mountain ranges or grandmothers or grandfathers who are just basically coming back all the time and checking on us. And I thought this is a really interesting subject, as well as I've travelled the world for the last 4 years and haven't made a film and had to pay off some bar tabs.
What do you think is the unique significance of ghost stories to Indigenous Australians?
I know, I can only talk on behalf of myself and the way I grew up. I'm sure that, in Italian society or Japanese society, there's, they have connections to their ancestors and that. But I just see a prevalence of that in my family, and that sort of connection that you want to respect and you want to recognise these people, because they're very quickly forgotten, in a sense, unless they were someone famous and a street or a bridge is named after them. We forget our ancestors. And traditionally, Aboriginal people would celebrate and have dance and corroborees to appease them, in a sense, to keep them happy, because we recognise that they're around us all the time. And it's quite difficult now with a loss of culture and language for a lot of Indigenous people, that they can't sing those songs or do those dances that would keep those ancestors happy. And I thought, well, let's try and create a new tact by maybe making a film about our ancestors and use true stories, true ghost stories, in a sense, to appease those ghosts that they're being recognised. Generally, when ghosts rock up, I think that they want to be found.
And I believe that spirit is still around that house, because that woman didn't like us taking her flowers.
For me growing up, ghost stories were a thing that happened when you sat around a campfire, maybe, or when, you had a sleepover and your friends told them almost like jokes. Yeah. But it seems that in Indigenous culture, they're given a much greater reverence.
Yeah, well, no, absolutely, you know, because a lot of it, you know, there are the urban myths and the kind of stories that have sort of come out of the mission in a sense, or come out of sort of more the dreaming, and they've sort of become a collective where someone says this happened on this mission, and then you'll go to another mission and they say that it happened there, and, you know, and they've become urban myths. And I was trying to keep away from those kind of stories. I wanted much more personal stories, and I wanted first-hand stories, sort of in living memory, oral history, which I found really important, that these stories could be passed on. Because a lot of people see ghosts and don't actually say that they did, because they kind of would be perceived as slightly wacko, or were you on drugs, or, you know, all that kind of stuff. And these are incredible stories, and they're just lost when people die because they just don't speak about them. And I'm trying to create this push to get these stories out.
Yeah, it was like I was paralyzed, and I couldn't move, you know, and this thing was just pushing my head deeper and deeper into the pillow, and I felt like I was getting pushed into this big hole.
Well, your film demonstrates that ghost stories do have an important place for Indigenous Australians. It does make me wonder the role of ghost stories for non-Indigenous Australians, and it seems that they are just used in that kind of fun storytelling, almost joke mythical space.
And to scare you, in a sense. You know, traditionally...
But not taken seriously.
Yeah, not taken seriously.
Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, it's kind of, you know, Christianity is a bit of a hard taskmaster in a sense. It likes to shut down everything around it, but, you know, God, Jesus, Mary, and that kind of existence is quite blinkered, and anything outside of that or any other is not sort of accepted in a sense. And so, and then, you know, Christianity has its followers, but there's a lot of people who don't. And then it's sort of just, you know, spirituality in a general sense is sort of really sort of watered down. And then you've got, you've got people who just live every day, and atheists and in a sense and all that kind of stuff, who don't believe in anything beyond, you know, the existence of who they are today.
In a more scientific way.
Yeah, in a more scientific way. And, you know, I think that's a really... You know, that's incredibly blinkered as well. You know, you've lost a lot of the beautiful journey that's happening around you, because you can't, if it doesn't fit into an equation, you can't believe in it, and that's really sad.
With the stories in your film that do go across Indigenous to non-Indigenous culture, like the Aboriginal woman who saw her white in-laws' ancestors, mm-hmm. or like the story that Claudia Carvin portrays, where a white woman on the North Shore of Sydney gets transported into this trance-like ceremony with mm-hmm. the ancestors of an Aboriginal friend of hers.
You know, I was being transported somewhere, and I was losing my kind of going to a different consciousness. And it was an incredible feeling.
Do you think maybe those kinds of sightings, stories, experiences could maybe help with reconciliation in Australia?
Well, maybe our spirits are reconciling much more than what we are, you know, and they're doing their part to gift, in a sense, stories and journeys and visions to non-Indigenous people just as much as Indigenous people, to say that, well, you know, you are a part of... See, the thing is, all Australians are a part of Indigenous history right now, you know, and that's really important to recognise that it's not a past history, it's not bad things that happened yesterday, and it's not good things that happened today. They're completely inverted, as the sense it's bad things happening to Indigenous people today, that we are all part of that history by either turning a blind eye or making a difference, you know. And, you know, and I think our spirits are trying to work in the same direction. There's a lot of non-Indigenous spirits who are probably reconciling with their past right now just as much as the living are.
Okay, and if any of you listening have a ghost story you want to tell, and potentially Warwick Thornton, an amazing Australian director, could make it into a feature film, you can actually go and submit it. TheOtherSideProject.com.au is the website. That's TheOtherSideProject.com.au. Warwick, thanks so much for coming in and telling us about your ghost stories and all about your film, The Dark Side.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Hack with Tom Tilley, Triple J.
Indigenous director Warwick Thornton talking about his new film, The Dark Side, which opens in cinemas in Sydney, Brisbane and Adelaide tomorrow, and then in Melbourne, Perth and Canberra early next year. Lots of people texting in. One person says, the only real dangerous thing in the equation when it comes to ghosts are humans. We only attract spirits that are a vibrational frequency that matches ours. Fear-based emotions emit a lower frequency and will attract spirits of a negative nature. I'm a natural medium and have only ever experienced bad spirits if my intentions were of a bad nature or if I was in a negative state of mind. And Mick says, ghosts? Really? Doesn't matter where the stories are coming from, it's all bullshit. Thank you for your thoughts, Mick. And lots of people texting about driving hungover as well, with lots of stories of blowing under the limit but then still being in a really bad state to drive. Chris from Victoria says, what if you drink 10 plus drinks but you don't get hangovers? Does this still count? Another person says, last weekend drove after a big night, breathalyzed myself and felt like I might blow over, but I was 0.00, drove but was very conscious of still feeling very impaired. And someone else says, it's just like driving jet lagged. Tomorrow on the show, we're talking about Tinder, very popular dating app. Catch you tomorrow.